You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. Well, it's Cybersecurity Month, and with me today is Matthew Eshelman, who is the Chief Technology Officer at Community IT, where he is responsible for shaping Community IT's strategy around the technology platforms used by organizations to secure their data and be productive. Matt has a deep background in network infrastructure. He fundamentally understands how secure technology works and interoperates in both office and in the cloud. Matt joined Community IT as an intern in the summer of 2000, and after finishing dual degrees in computer science and computer information systems at Eastern Mennonite University, he joined Community IT as a network administrator in January 2001. Matt has steadily progressed at Community IT and, while working full-time, received his MBA from the Carey School of Business at Johns Hopkins. He now serves, as I mentioned, as Chief Technology Officer and Cybersecurity Expert. And that's what we're going to talk to him today about, cybersecurity. Matt, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Great. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, Matt, I really am fascinated by this topic, because there's so many things that I simply don't understand. Now, I do appreciate that there are nefarious people who live in our world and who want to find different ways to take advantage of people. And yet, the whole issue of cybersecurity crimes is one that is somewhat puzzling to me, because in many cases, organizations and people are so vulnerable that we don't even know how to protect ourselves. And yet we do know that this is a rising crime and also a very costly crime. And so what I want to try to do today is kind of break it down to a layman's understanding. Many of us don't even understand what's happening to us. And I'm hoping that you can kind of clarify some things for us. And, you know, a lot of people don't even understand what charities are going through and what some of the vulnerabilities are that we have. You know, we're a mission-based organization. We're trying to take the money that we get from donors and apply it to the cause for which we were established. And to have to spend money protecting our data and protecting our computer systems and our devices is something that for many of us is quite foreign. And we don't necessarily have the skills and abilities to understand. And donors need to, I hope, appreciate the cost associated with us just protecting ourselves and what we have to go through. So I would love to be able to get into that a little bit with you. Matt, tell us about Community IT.
So Community IT, we are a 100% employee-owned company, and we have a staff of about 40 individuals. And our entire focus is really on helping nonprofit organizations advance their mission through the effective use of technology. So we're technology experts, and we have been consistently named a top 501 managed service provider by Channel Futures. And so we provide ongoing managed services to nonprofit organizations, along with cybersecurity services and ongoing consulting. I've been at Community IT for actually over 20 years. I started as an intern in 2000, and after I finished my degree, I came back to work. And so now in my role as Chief Technology Officer, I'm really responsible for shaping the technology strategy that we use to support those 5,000 staff at the nonprofit clients we work with, and then also work with nonprofit organizations to help them shape their technology strategy. So I think Community IT is a really great place. Obviously, I've been here for 20 years, and we've got employee owners that come from over 12 nations. And one of the great things about Community IT is, I think, our diversity of our staff. So we have over 65% of our staff would self-identify as part of a traditionally underrepresented and underserved demographic. And so I think that's important that we are reflective of the clients that we work with.
With you. So let me just start by asking you just some basic information about the extent of the problem. Has it been calculated, to your knowledge, the amount of money that is lost due to cyber crimes and the amounts that people have to spend once they have been affected by a cyber crime?
So the amount of, you know, financial impact that cybercrime causes is measured by the FBI. So if you've been a victim of cybercrime, this may be something you've actually reported to the Internet Crime Complaint Center. So that's something that the FBI maintains as a website. And so they calculate the actual direct financial costs associated with cybercrime. And that number has really gone up dramatically year after year. So looking back at 2016, they had a little under 300,000 incidents reported with about $1.5 billion of direct damage. And that number has really gone up. And so last year in 2020, there were almost 800,000 incidents reported, which represented a financial loss of about $4.2 billion. So obviously that's a tremendous amount of money associated with cybercrime. And I think that crime word is operative, right? This is a business. Hackers are in there in large part for financial motivations. We certainly see some organizations that are targeted for the work that they do, but in general, it's about the money. This is, people can get paid for hacking, and so that's what they're doing.
So let's talk for a minute about the hackers or the people who get paid. How are they getting paid? Are they being hired by people to go out and hack systems? Is it the data that they get that they sell? What are we talking about here?
The data shows that there can be many different ways that the data can be monetized. So it could be something like stealing credit card numbers and using that for credit card fraud. It could be direct ransomware. I think that's certainly something that we see a lot in the news. Your data gets encrypted and then you have to pay to get it unlocked. Or it could be other forms of information that is being captured, whether it be, you know, proprietary information about, you know, maybe your business operations or medical records. You know, any type of data can be monetized. And so I think the number one way that they're making money is on the ransomware payments. But, you know, straight up credit card fraud, gift card fraud are all ways that organizations can be impacted financially by these attackers.
Wow, it's sad because, you know, charities really don't have money to give away like that. I mean, they're trying to accomplish something, as I said, yet you could be a victim of a ransomware attack. So let's talk for a minute, just give everybody some clarity around what we're talking about when we say a ransomware attack. What is that?
So a ransomware attack is something that happens where a file or a malicious process may get onto your computer, and then it encrypts your data so that you can't access it. So what will happen is a virus may run on your computer, it encrypts all your data, and then all that's left is maybe a message on your screen or a little text file that says, hey, your file has been encrypted. Here's instructions for how to get it back. Go to this website, maybe get some Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency and pay us, and then we'll unlock your data. So for many organizations, they find out that maybe their backups aren't as good as they thought they were, or data wasn't protected in a way that they thought it was. And so they're forced or, you know, coerced into paying to decrypt the data so they can get back into their systems.
So when they pay, do these ransom attackers actually give them their data back? I mean,
I think, you know, that's the million-dollar question, and that's why the FBI does encourage organizations to not pay the ransom. There is no way to guarantee that the decryption key is going to work. So these are pretty complicated operations. So if you pay and you get a decryption key to access your data again, there could be problems with decrypting. Often you need to download that information from a anonymous website. There's ongoing law enforcement operations that are taking down those sites on an ongoing basis. So it could be by the time you get a decryption key that site has been taken down. So it's never a good idea to pay ransom. It's always a good idea, if you can, to be prepared so that your organization doesn't get that crypto attack in the first place. And if you do, that you have a backup of your data so that you can recover from that sort of attack.
So what if I'm not prepared? You don't have necessarily a choice then but to pay. I mean, your information is essential to providing the service. And if you can't get your information, you're basically starting from scratch. You're sort of, you know, swimming in the water without a life jacket in terms of trying to get your organization up and running. I mean, we rely on our data and our systems to do our work. So without that information, we're kind of stuck. So you pay this potentially and you don't get your information back, and it's kind of a double loss. So you pretty much have to assume then, I guess, that once you've been hacked, once you've been given a ransom request, that your data is just lost and you just need to start all over. Is that pretty much what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is an area where, you know, the old adage of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is really appropriate. So, you know, you've touched on it. For an organization, you know, your data is your most important asset. And so being able to understand, you know, what data you have, which systems is it located in, and then how is that data protected are really important questions to ask. And I think that's a fundamental cybersecurity control that every organization needs to take into account. And so every organization needs to include that backup plan as part of their baseline. Like, you can't have a system in place without understanding how you're protecting that data. Even if it's information that's in, you know, a third party vendor's cloud system, you need to understand how they're protecting your data, what their abilities are to recover if something should happen. And that's why we include that as one of the foundational controls that we recommend in our cybersecurity roadmap that we put out as a resource, just to make sure that organizations really have a good handle on, again, what data do they have, where does it live, and how is it protected?
Yeah, I want to get into that roadmap. But first, I want to just help people understand what we're talking about when we say data, because it just sounds like this thing, right? It just sounds like, oh, data, what is it? So we want to let people know, if you're an organization, one of the big pieces of data you may have if you raise money is information about people who gave you money. You use that information so that you can fundraise. Mm-hmm. If someone gives you money, you get their name, address. Sometimes you get credit card information, banking information, although I would hope charities are really careful about holding on to that information. You don't really need to hold on to that, but maybe some do. And then you essentially will use it to appeal to people to give you money. That's one form of data that I assume a hacker can access. And in that case, it would be a double whammy. They could take the information and potentially sell it, if they had credit card information and others, to someone, some really dirty person who might want to use that information, and then also keep you from actually using it. So that's one. Another might be, you have information about people who you're serving in your program, right? So if you're in the business of training people for jobs, let's say, now they have access to your records for all your students, and you need that information because you're tracking how people are progressing through your program, and now you don't have that information anymore. It could also be software, right, that you're using to actually train people that you can't access anymore. So people can't get the education they need because it's all digitized, right? And when students come to your program, they're using this information on your computers to access their training and their lessons. And you can just envision, you can think about how an organization is run, and you can see more and more applications that could be in jeopardy as a result of something like that. And that's just in one type of organization. So this is obviously a major concern. And as I said before, charities don't have, you know, extra money sitting around just to pay ransoms. You know, in the corporate world, you know, they can go to the marketplace if they have to. They can issue bonds. They can do what they have to do to get money, to do what they have to do to save their information. And of course, their system should be more sophisticated anyway. But charities are really vulnerable. And I should, maybe I shouldn't be saying that, because there's a hacker somewhere listening who's probably thinking, oh, we should begin going after charities. Thanks, Art, for letting us know that. But the better thing is to do, Matt, what you're suggesting, and that is to begin protecting your organization. So let's talk about some of the ways in which an organization can avoid this from happening, or if it does happen, be prepared. What are some of the things organizations can do?
So I think it's important for organizations to actually start with policy. That's where we like to start with the clients that we work with. And it's, and it doesn't have to be a big, complex document, but just having a basic IT acceptable use policy where you sit down and just kind of go through some different scenarios and establish the baseline criteria for what you expect to be able to do at your organization. So again, you know, answering those questions like, you know, what data do we have? Where does it live? What's our password policy? How long do we need to keep data? What do we expect around people using their personal devices to access our organizational data? So answering these questions in a policy document is a great way to build a framework that you can implement technical solutions on top of that. So again, if we can start with policy just to answer some of those basic questions, that gives a good framework to be able to answer some of the technical questions later on. And then, so specifically on the technical questions, it may sound basic, but updating your computer on a regular basis, that's a really good security step to take, because hackers are exploiting vulnerabilities that are disclosed in the operating system in third-party applications. And so if you can get your system up to date and keep it up to date, that's a really great security step. We talked about it before, but having backups of your data in a system that you control. So backups of your files, if you have data in third-party systems, your fundraising database, your accounting system, making sure that you've got that data backed up outside of that vendor. So if something happens to them, you're able to get that data back. That's a really critical step. So just because it's in the cloud doesn't mean it's protected in the way that you think it is. And unfortunately, we've run into organizations that, you know, that found that out the hard way. They had assumed, oh, our data is in the cloud, it's backed up, it's protected, but maybe the vendor was only protecting it for 30 days and they needed a file that somebody deleted 31 days ago. So that's an important step. And then the other piece I would say is really important is protecting our digital identity. So anything that you can log into online with a username and password, that means a hacker can do the same thing. So protecting that online identity with what is called multi-factor authentication is probably one of the most important things that you can do. So again, multi-factor authentication means that you use something that you know, which is your password, along with something you have, which is often an app on your smartphone that generates a random code or that sends you a notification when you log in. That is really effective in preventing hackers from getting into your system, because as we know, there's all kinds of password breaches and all these things happen. And so if you can prevent that hacker, even if they find your password, they're not going to have your phone as well. And so having multi-factor authentication is a really important step that people can take to protect access to those digital resources.
So in a multi-factor, you can imagine a lot of people saying, I don't want to take the extra time to have to go to get a code on my phone just so I can log into my computer. Nobody's really after us. We don't have a big organization. Why would anybody come deal with us? Can you explain how easy it is, or how likely it is, or possible it is for a person to access one of your devices through a password?
Well, what I can say is, so we put out an incident report that we call it the Nonprofit Cybersecurity Incident Report, where we categorize all of the service tickets that we respond to. You know, we support about 5,000 users at nonprofit organizations. And 96% of the accounts that were compromised that we responded to did not have multi-factor authentication enabled. It's a striking number. If you're really targeted, the bad guys may try to find a way, even if you have multi-factor authentication, to get into your accounts. But the vast, vast majority of cases, if you've got multi-factor authentication, you're going to be protected. And I would say the other thing that I've noticed, you know, we've been advocating for multi-factor authentication probably for 4 years now in terms of our standard practice. It's gotten a lot easier because I think as individuals, we see multi-factor authentication in place at a lot of other places now. You know, if you log into your online banking system, multi-factor authentication is now required. You know, if you log into, you know, Facebook, you know, they're starting to add in other factors. And so it's not so much of a battle anymore because I think people are more familiar with it. And the training and the people's ability to get onboarded into the system has really improved. And we don't get nearly as much pushback on this issue now as we did, you know, when we were trying to make it the standard about, you know, 4 years ago.
So talk for a minute about the importance of updating your computer software. So I know we get notices, update, you know, run this update. And a lot of times you're in the middle of something and the thing pops up on your screen to update your computer and you ignore it. What's the vulnerability there? Somebody told me that whenever an update from a piece of software comes out, that hackers look for that. And then they know, oh, somebody out there didn't do that update. And this is sometimes a way in. Is that true or am I missing something?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. So whenever there's a security vulnerability that's disclosed, that's often published, sometimes there are people that, you know, go for what are called bug bounties, right? They're trying to find vulnerabilities within software. In the best of cases, they work with a vendor to patch it. They release the patch and you can install that and move ahead. But it also does mean that there is often some information that's disclosed about how this vulnerability can be exploited. And so I think that's why it's important to have a regular patching cycle. I know it's annoying to get those updates, but those updates are there to protect you, your computer, your organization's data. And if you can get into a habit of, you know, rebooting your computer once a week, that'll take care of it. And so one of the things that you can do is maybe at the end of the day on Friday, instead of closing the lid on your laptop, just hit start, restart. And then that will install the updates in the background. Your computer will be ready for you when you get there on Monday, and you won't get prompted for those, you know, that update in the middle of an important meeting. And it's just a good practice to make sure that the updates are installed, everything is working correctly, and you're getting the most recent updates that are available for your system.
You know, I bet a lot of people don't even realize how important it is to reboot your computer. As you said, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of times people will just close the lid on their laptop thinking that that's enough, you know, that they're protected and that they're doing everything they need to do, not realizing that it's the reboot that actually enables the updates to take place. And if you don't do that, then you're not really protecting yourself to the full extent. I bet people don't even realize that. So would that be something that would be part of an organization's policy? You know, every week or every night you need to shut your computer down fully, or might that be something? Or
yeah, I think it's a good security practice for organizations to, you know, to talk to their staff about. Once a week is what we recommend and suggest, something that's, you know, it's what I follow to make sure that my computer is running, has the most recent patches. And, you know, both Microsoft and Apple are now, they're releasing security updates on a, you know, monthly basis. They are working to install them silently in the background, but the computer does need to be restarted for those updates to be completely applied. And having that restart allows that installation to complete and everything to be working correctly.
Matt, we've heard a lot of conversations about the cloud. We're always told about this cloud. What is the cloud? And what should organizations do with their data? Should they be trying to support it themselves or put it on their own servers, or should they be using cloud-based services? So can you kind of explain in basic terms what we mean when we say cloud?
So to me, I think the cloud is a term that talks about a set of technologies that's accessible over the internet, and it really focuses on the software and services being delivered instead of managing the underlying, you know, hardware resources. So the two big examples of cloud services that we interact with the most would be Microsoft's Office 365 platform. So again, that would be your email, you know, files, chat, all of that delivered through the web, or Google Workplace. Again, a similar thing where there's email, you know, files, chat, all available through the web. And so, you know, as a user of those cloud services, you don't necessarily know, you know, which server that data is living on, where it is, how is it backed up, how is it managed. That's not something that you're really focused on. You're just focused on using those services and connecting to it securely. So I think that to me is an example of kind of a pure cloud service where you turn on your computer, you connect to the internet, and you're able to access all of those things without a lot of additional configuration. And I do think nonprofits have done a really good job of adopting cloud services, I think at a faster rate than the for-profit world, because of the generous donation and discount programs that those big vendors have been able to extend to the nonprofit community. So that to me is a very positive thing, because I don't think nonprofits really should be in the business of managing the IT infrastructure and the hardware and focusing on those IT operations. I think the use of cloud services allows organizations to focus on the work and the mission and using technology, as opposed to deploying servers and, you know, setting up hardware and doing all that back-end work. So I do think cloud technology is a really good benefit for nonprofit organizations to take advantage of.
So let's talk for a minute about passwords. You know, we have so many applications in our life, right? We have, you know, probably each person probably has 20 or 30 things that they're probably, you know, accessing via a password, maybe more. I don't know if you know the exact count that on average, how many passwords we have to do different things, but it's hard to keep track of all that. And then you have to change it periodically. Are there systems for, let's say, changing your password so that you can kind of know what you're dealing with and you don't have to always just come up with something new that you have to write down somewhere and then it's vulnerable, or to make it easy for you to remember, but something that you can change as well? Are there ways to systematize that so you do it regularly? And, you know, we always get this request now to take our password to something that's very difficult to hack. So we get the request, you know, do you want this more difficult password, or do you want to set your own? And I always pick my own, but maybe sometimes I should pick the more difficult one, but I could never remember that. I'll never remember that, the one that they had. So what do we do? What's the answer here?
Yes. I think it's a really good question. I mean, and so what I'll tell you is that I know three passwords. That's it. I know the password to get into my computer. I know the password for my password manager, and I know my encryption key. So that's it. So I use a password manager. There are a lot of different ones out there. LastPass, Dashlane, 1Password. And these are great tools. They are secure. And what they do is give you the ability to generate new, unique, strong passwords for every different system that you need to access. And then whenever you're on a web page, it'll automatically fill in that information. And then you're able to log right in. They have added in some nice features. So if there is a breach, because we know that passwords are compromised, you know, you on a regular basis. They'll send you an alert saying, hey, we detected that this website that you had an account at was compromised. Let's rotate just that password. And so it gives you a way to securely store and manage unique passwords for all the different systems that you have access to. And it is a tremendous amount of systems. I mean, I don't know. I probably have accounts at 100 different websites, and those all need to be unique, because what happens is that once a hacker gets a password for one site, they'll go and try that at other sites. And so again, you know, that website that you signed up for a couple years ago, if you were in the bad habit of reusing passwords, and you know, the password you use to log into Chuck E. Cheese is also the same password for your organizational email, that can be a problem. So again, using a password manager is a really great way to generate unique, strong passwords for all those different systems, and then just rely on that to autofill in there.
Now, are these password managers themselves protected so that people can't access them?
Yes. I mean, you know, I think there is this, you know, discussion about what happens if that system is hacked. And I think that that's a trade-off that I think is worth making, because, you know, there's some open source ones, there's commercial ones that are incented to create strong systems that have good controls in place so that they can, you know, be well protected. And again, I think the risk is that if you don't use a password manager and you try to have your own system where you're remembering 50, 60 different unique passwords for every different website that you go to, then you're going to actually be in a position where you're creating bad passwords, reusing passwords, you know, adding one onto your password. And so that puts you in a really weak position. And so the trade-off, I think, is use a password manager, you know, have confidence in that system. If there is a breach, you know, it's going to be reported. You may need to reset passwords at that point, but I think that's a relatively small chance as opposed to the risk of just trying to keep all that in your head or in a notebook or something like that.
Well, let me ask you now, one of the things we try to help people with, you know, average donors, is to better understand what happens to their information when they make a donation. You know, when you make a donation, the charity's collecting some information about you. And a lot of times it's important that people know. So we tell charities, you know, you need to have a data security and a data privacy statement on your website. And what do you think that should be included or contained in that, so people understand what their potential vulnerabilities are when they make that donation, if they want to know?
Yeah, I think that is a good standard to have in place. I think people, whenever they give to an organization, do expect that their data is, you know, used correctly and used, you know, by that organization alone, and their data is not going to be, you know, sold or reused in a way that is not expected. So I think it is important to start, again, with that policy. We talked about IT acceptable use policy. And again, I think that data privacy and data security policies are also very important to have in order to ensure that you can build confidence in the organization that the data is going to be protected and handled in a secure way. I think organizations also, especially if you're using credit card information, there's already some security policies that are going to come along with that as it relates to PCI compliance. And so that's payment processing certification process that the credit card industry is involved in. And so, again, if you're using these online systems, they're going to be PCI compliant. And so there's a whole set of standards that goes along with that to make sure that data is handled correctly, the process is secure, and that the information is going to be handled in a secure and safe manner.
How about when we also try to advise people about being careful where they go? So sometimes, you know, you'll get an email saying donate to a particular charity, and there's a link in the email taking you to a website. And most of the time it's to the charity's website. But we've also found that not many charities solicit for the first time that way. And so if you get an email, it's probably better to just go to the charity's website independently of the link. Just type in the name of the charity in your browser and go to the charity's website without that link, because we've noticed that there may be fictitious websites set up from what we call sound-alike charities.
Mm-hmm.
And you can possibly give your money to something that isn't what you intended to give to. Is there a way people can tell when they click on that link that this might be a phony website or a look-alike website? How difficult is it to tell?
So I think it's a good question, because we do know that a lot of the financial fraud does start with an email, and being able to identify malicious links in an email is I think an important part of security awareness training. And so your point about going to the charity's website directly and then looking for the donate button, you know, is a secure way or to ensure that you know that you're going to the right website, because emails can be spoofed. Again, we talk about hacking. You know, you could actually get an email from a legitimate sender, but then, you know, the link that's in there is malicious. So I think if you can go to the charity's website directly, that gives you a lot of confidence, because even if you get a message from somebody that you know, the link in there could also be malicious or spoofed. So we always say, you know, think before you click, take a look. You can hover over the website and or hover over the link in an email, and it'll display the website, and you can oftentimes take a look and see if that makes sense. You know, is it actually going to, you know, the charity itself, or is it going to some other name that looks a little bit different? So if you're ever in doubt, you know, go to the charity's website directly. You know, if you have an IT person at your organization, or if you have an IT help desk, you know, send that ticket to them. You can have them look at it first before going to the website.
Great. So larger charities can afford to have people on staff who manage security, who are doing maybe even software engineering, programming, and as you mentioned, help desk services for employees who need problem solve with their devices and their software. Smaller charities don't necessarily have that. But what can you do as a smaller organization? Are there consultants out there that can give smaller organizations the support they need so that they don't have to have someone on staff that may be very expensive to procure? How do smaller organizations go about this?
Yes, there are lots of different IT vendors out there that focus on small businesses. There's even organizations like Community IT that focus, you know, exclusively on nonprofits. And so what we really like to see is organizations go through an RFP process to have some formal evaluation framework where they're pretty clear on, hey, here's what we have, here's what we need, and here's what we're looking for in a partner. And I think it is important that organizations find somebody or find an independent contractor or a vendor that works with other charities. Because what we found, we've been working with nonprofit organizations for over 20 years. That's all we do. And we do find that the organizational culture, the technology needs of charities are different from, you know, small and mid-sized businesses. And so if you work with a vendor that, you know, primarily works with businesses and they, you know, decide they want to do some good and work with some charities, that often can be a little bit of a misalignment or a misfit because they don't understand the unique challenges that charities face. So I would look for somebody or some company that works with nonprofit organizations as a predominant part of their business, because they will understand the organization's culture, and the technology tools that are available for nonprofits.
That's great advice. And yet I also think that many nonprofits don't even know how to go about selecting an IT or a software vendor. You know, you don't know what to do. You don't even know if it's a good vendor or not. When you see a resume, it's like Greek, reading the Greek. And, you know, Greek is a beautiful language, but if you don't know how to speak it, it's challenging, right? So when I came into this job 20 years ago now, I didn't need to know anything about this. We were certainly in the computer age, but we weren't as concerned about our information being stolen and having our systems frozen by hackers who want to get ransom and so forth. And yet today, all of our work is pretty much digitized. And we have to know a lot more as nonprofit leaders about how this works. And one of the most difficult things, again, is to understand who the best people are and how you get them. And even understanding if they're doing their jobs. You know, we don't even know if they are in fact doing their jobs. We assume that if nothing has gone wrong, that they are, but that may not be the case. So should we get audits of our systems? How do we go about, number one, identifying good vendors, and two, knowing that the people we've hired are actually doing their jobs and doing their jobs well?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And I would say that what I would look for in an IT provider is somebody that, you know, maybe has the heart of a teacher, somebody that's able to explain the concepts to you as a non-technical person in a way that makes sense to you. I would say we work with many, many organizations where our primary contact is the office manager or the finance associate or somebody in that role, a non-technical person. And we've had great relationships because they are good at their jobs. They know the organization really well, and they can ask good questions. And being able to have a conversation about, you know, what do you need as an organization, identifying requirements, being clear about, you know, what needs to happen in a way that the contact that you have at the IT company is able to take that and say, okay, I understand you're trying to accomplish this. Here's the specific steps that we're going to take to address that concern, is a way that you can have that as a conversation. So I don't think you need to be technical. I think you need to be able to ask good questions and have a partner in your IT provider that's able to explain things to you in a way that you can understand. I think you should not feel like you're being talked down to. I think that is an unfortunate stereotype in the IT world, is, as you know, the IT people tend to be kind of gatekeepers and talking down in jargon and use all kinds of acronyms. So I would say if you can have a good relationship with the IT partner, have them explain things to you in a way that you understand, that's the mark of a good relationship. And then in terms of independent assessments, I think that's something we do see at larger organizations. You know, smaller organizations just may not have the capacity or the budget to get that independent assessment, and so you are more reliant on that good relationship. At larger organizations, we certainly do welcome the clients that we work with. If they get an independent assessment of the work that we do, I think that's a good thing. And I think if you have an IT team in place, if they feel confident in the work that they're doing, having an independent assessment is a great opportunity to validate the work that's being done and then give that an additional perspective. So yeah, if you're in a larger organization, maybe 50 staff and up, then maybe every 3 years having an independent assessment would be a good way just to validate the work that's being done, you know, by your in-house IT team or if you have a consulting partner or company.
Well, Matt, as we wind down, I want to make sure that I've covered everything that you believe I should. By the way, we're here with Matthew Eshelman, who is the Chief Technology Officer at Community IT. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the services offered by Community IT so that people who might want to reach out to you and access you for support know how to do that and know what they could expect.
So in terms of what organizations need to have for their cybersecurity controls, I think we talked about a lot of it. So starting with policy, making sure computers are backed up, making sure we've got multi-factor authentication and backups is really the key piece. I think the one thing we haven't really talked about that I would like to squeeze in here is just security awareness training. So again, that is not a technical thing, but what we found is that investing in your people is the best return on investment. So again, if you can provide security awareness training for your staff so that they don't click on that malicious link, so that they know how to generate a good password, so that they know how to use multi-factor authentication, that provides a tremendous return. You know, in the cybersecurity world, you can buy all kinds of very fancy technology solutions to put in place. But if you can train your users not to click on stuff and restart their computer on a regular basis, then you're getting, you know, you get a lot of value out of that. So the security awareness training is something that I think every organization should be investing in, because it's a very efficient use of those limited funds that you do have. And again, talking about prevention is a much better situation to be in than reacting to a security incident after it's occurred.
Great. And one final question has to do with insurance. Should organizations get insurance, and how available is insurance for data breaches and potentially, in this case, we were talking about ransom attacks?
Yes. So I think the cyber liability insurance market has really changed dramatically over the last 3 years. Whenever we first started talking with our clients about this, you could essentially fill out the form, get coverage. It wasn't very expensive. You didn't have to have anything in place. They would write a policy. That all has changed dramatically in the last year. So now we're seeing organizations need to implement a lot of cybersecurity controls before they'll even be considered for coverage. And so I do think organizations should have it. I think it's important for organizations to understand that their general operating liability insurance coverage is not going to cover cyber events. So again, if you get a ransomware attack, that's not going to be covered by your current insurance. If you do have cyber liability coverage, that could be something that would be covered there. So organizations should be aware of the coverage that they currently have, and then also be aware if they have cyber liability insurance. We're really seeing the requirements get amped up in terms of what's expected before policy will even be written.
Wonderful. Well, Matt, I really am grateful to you for joining me today on the Heart of Giving podcast. This is really important information, and it's not only organizations that need to know this who are trying to operate, but I think it's important for donors and constituents of charities to understand what we're dealing with as charitable organizations, so that can appreciate when an organization comes to you and says, can you support us financially? And you say to them, well, we want our dollars to go to the programs. Well, understand that an organization really can't operate anymore just putting money on programs. They have to make sure that their data is protected, that they're actually collecting the right data, that they're ensuring their operations. All of this costs money. And I know that, you know, when you talk to a person, they're going to say, you know, I want, you know, 80, 90% of my money to go to a charity's programs. Well, that's impossible, because there are these administrative and other operational costs that charities have to pay just in order to operate. So, Matt, you've given us some great insight here, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing at Community IT to help organizations. And I certainly look forward to working with you in other ways to help charities prosper and not be subject to the kinds of attacks that many institutions are vulnerable for. So thank you so much. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll listen to other episodes by just going to any of the major podcast platforms. You can also follow us and subscribe on Patreon if you want to make a donation, patreon.com. And also make a comment on, especially on Apple Podcasts. We would love to get a favorable review on Apple Podcasts, because that helps us to build audience. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only, and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.